Me.
Focus Features presents Back to Black.
I want people to hear my voice and just forget their troubles.
Experience the music and her story.
Know this,
I ain't no Spice Girl.
Like never before.
That's my daughter, that's my Amy.
On the big screen.
I want to be remembered for just being me.
Amy Winehouse, Back to Black, directed by Sam Taylor Johnson. Rated R, under 17, not a minute without parent. Only in theaters May 17th.
This is your moment, your time to shine, your comeback. You're ready for the next step in your career, and you want an education employers respect. So you're not just going back to school. You're coming back with Purdue Global. Backed by Purdue University, one of the nation's most respected public universities, Purdue Global is built for people who bring their life experience into the online classroom. Purdue Global, Purdue's online university for working adults. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
What kind of fun is waiting for you at Kings Island? The holy cow, we're way too high and here comes the drop kind of fun. The make a splash all summer kind of fun. The I can't believe I ate that whole funnel cake. Let's get another kind of fun. But most importantly, at Kings Island, you'll find for the fun of it kind of fun.
Don't wait to start your fun season. Kings Island is now open on weekends.
What's engaged in a conspiracy against all civilization? My Catholic Church! This is Behind the Bastards, a podcast that focuses on the evils of the false pope in Rome. We are, of course, devotees of the anti-pope Novatian, who carried out a righteous rebellion against the power of Pope Cornelius in the mid-200s. God rest his soul. James, what's the chief thing you've learned from the anti-pope Novatian?
I don't know. His input on hair and skincare has been really important to me.
Yeah. He had a lot to say about that in the Latin language, which he was the first Roman theologian to use. I'm just learning about him now on Wikipedia. I don't know why I went with this as the introduction for the
nobody
episode.
Nobody knows, Robert.
Nobody knows. Nobody knows. Nobody knows. No. But you know what? This is now a podcast dedicated to the anti-pope Novatian, who lived from 280 to 258. Wow.
Yeah, well, it's a big change from our last episode, which was, of course, dedicated to a dead groundhog. So.
That's right. They have a lot in common, the anti-pope and that groundhog that Bill de Blasio killed.
Did Bill de Blasio drop the anti-pope on his brain as
just
well?
An incredible piece of information you gave us, James.
Yeah, I'm going to make one more request from the artists to our fans, which is a Roman style relief, like the ceiling of the Vatican.
Chapel.
That's like anti-pope Novatian and that fucking groundhog holding hands in the sky.
Press your power, Kings. Do it as a mural. Find a building. It doesn't matter who owns it. Draw that as a mural, and we will send you a t-shirt.
Let those two kings be the symbol of our next revolution.
Hand in paw.
The anti-pope riding into battle on a dead
groundhog.
Finally, de Blasio will get his comeuppance. So, speaking of Bill de Blasio, the first official Nazi party outside of Germany was formed in Paraguay in 1927 under a mango tree in the capital. While Forster, that anti-Semitic philosopher we talked about last time, had been a miserable failure in his goal of creating an Aryan sanctuary, his published writings traveled across the world and became kind of a leading light for several generations of German anti-Semites. One of these anti-Semites was a guy you might have heard of named Adolf Hitler. He comes across Forster's readings as a young man, and he reveres them so much that when he comes to power, he sends a bunch of German soil over to Paraguay so that local Nazis can cover Forster's grave. He also allegedly sends along a tombstone plaque with the words, "The place where the father of Nazism lies," inscribed upon it. Now, there's... Yeah.
If we have any listeners in Paraguay, that's a great thing to tag.
Yeah, that would be a nice thing to destroy.
There is some groundhog on it.
Yeah, groundhog that fucker. Give it the old Bill de Blasio treatment and drop it. There is debate over whether or not Hitler is the person who sent this plaque, but the plaque does exist. British historian Ben McIntyre is one of the people who considers it likely that Hitler would have said this. Obviously, that doesn't mean that he was like the only ideological father of Nazism. Hitler could be a flatterer when he wanted to be. But it is kind of beyond arguing that Hitler was a fan of this guy and that Forster influenced his attitudes. As a result of all this, it is perhaps not surprising that Nazism held an allure to some segments of the Paraguayan populace. The nation's first national police director named his son Adolfo and demanded police cadets wear swastikas on their uniforms.
This is a post 1945 swastika, right?
No. These are pre 45. Okay, post 33 though. Yeah.
Okay. Still probably a poor decision.
Yeah.
Did he then say it's just a Buddhist symbol, bro? Or yeah. Standard.
It means peace.
It's older than time.
Yeah. Now Paraguay also, speaking of bad decisions, sided with the Nazis in World War II. Initially. So they kind of switch their allegiances midway through the war when it's like, you know what? Look, Paraguay's got a history of being on the wrong side of wars. We don't want to risk that this time. And obviously also, like, it doesn't really matter what side of World War II Paraguay was on. They are a landlocked country in South America. Yeah. They're not going to play a role in the fighting. the government, though, the Paraguayan government does switch their allegiances right before the end. It is worth noting that the Paraguayan Nazi Party refuses to give up the ghost until 1946. So Paraguay's Nazi Party lasts longer than the original one. That's
great.
At least later. Yeah.
Well done then.
After the war, this tiny landlocked nation seemed like an enticing new home to dozens of former SS men and other fascist war criminals. Paraguay already had a modest German-speaking population based around Mennonite colonists, but it was also full of, and this kind of made it less desirable, it was also a place where a lot of white Russian officers had fled, some of whom had helped out in the Chaco War. These guys, some of them didn't like the fascists. Some of them were also very sympathetic to the Nazis because, like, you know, Stalin and the white Russians, not a great mix. So on the whole, this,
fucking white Russians end up everywhere. Like, I've recently been on a kick about reading about white Russians in the Spanish Civil War who end up all over the international brigades.
And a lot of these guys are czarists, a lot of these guys are fascists, a lot of these guys are the kinds of czarists that are basically fascists. In any case, it's a nice place to be a Nazi after World War II, Paraguay. So Nazis start filtering in there. A lot of them settle with Mennonites. At least one Mennonite community adopts a pro-Nazi school curricula for its children as a result of this.
Oh, God.
Yeah.
Don't speak that shit into reality, because Ron DeSantis will be all over it.
Yeah, fucking Mennonazis, Jesus. Others simply took Nazi money.
To be
money
fair, and, if they'd all been Mennonites, and we probably wouldn't have had quite so many issues with them.
No.
Just technologically speaking.
Yeah, they already mostly did shit on horseback anyway. As illustrated in probably the best scene of Band of Brothers. God, that show did a lot right. There's this great scene where, like, a bunch of American soldiers are, like, riding in after kind of the Nazi regime collapses, and they see all these, like, German POWs hauling shit on horses while they're on the back of a Jeep, and they're like, fucking horses! Like, you thought you could win this war, and you've got fucking horses? What's wrong with you people? It's very funny. These Nazis start winding up all over the fucking place, and they decide, like, you know what Paraguay would be great for is a smuggling base for Odessa, the organization of former SS men who helped each other smuggle themselves into other countries in order to avoid prosecution for doing a Holocaust. Now, some of my sources will argue that, like, Stressner was the kind of guy who wasn't really ideologically committed to much of anything other than being in power. But that's also essentially the ideology of a lot of surviving Nazi officials. So Stressner and the Nazis got along pretty well. And there are some allegations, most notably from Alex Shumatov, that Stroessner was at least Nazi curious. Shumatov basically claims that in his early life, Stroessner had little contact with Germans in Paraguay, but that this changed in his 30s, and he kind of became a Germanophile, you know, getting in touch with his dad's people. I'm going to quote from Vanity Fair again here. One of Stroessner's German buddies was Hans Rudel, a flying ace in the Luftwaffe who flew more missions than anyone, destroyed a cruiser, a battleship, 519 Russian tanks, was shot down twice, lost his right leg below the calf, but continued to excel at tennis and water skiing, was the idol of the post-war German Reich, the embodiment of Aryan perfection. Hitler created a special medal with him, the Knight's Cross with golden oak leaves. After the war, he tried out planes for the Argentinian government, and when Perón fell in 1955, was given asylum by his friend Stroessner, when Argentina was no longer safe for ex-Nazis. Rudel went to Paraguay as well and worked in the Ferreta Paraguaya in Asunción, selling BMWs, telephones, cement, and iron. He also worked for Odessa. So he's like a BMW dealer who's smuggling the Waffen SS out of Europe and into Argentina.
It's like the Forrest Gump of Nazis here. He just pays all the high points. It's an Eastern Front fucking Argentina.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he's all over the fucking place, in addition to selling used cars.
Yeah, so you've got to have a side hustle.
Stroessner and Rudel become fast friends, and working with Rudel, Stroessner sets up a system whereby new passports and visas can be sold for an exorbitant price, of which he got a cut, to old Nazis. And one of the Nazis who takes advantage of this very forgiving Paraguayan government policy is another fella you might have heard of, Dr. Joseph Mengele. So,
Glad that showed up. Good.
Mengele.
Yeah. So I was looking forward to that this Friday afternoon.
Yeah. So if you're not up on your Mengele, the kind of Cliff's Notes of this guy is that he's a doctor at Auschwitz who performs fatal experiments on 1,500 sets of twin children. He did shit like inject colored eye into like the eyes of toddlers, colored dye into the eyes of toddlers who were twins to like see if it affected the other twin. It was like nonsense. It was crazy nonsense. That's Dr. Joseph Mengele. He's a terrible person. We will cover him at some point. He's one of those guys like Durlwanger who he's not like... Mengele himself is not the most fascinating individual, so a lot of it's just kind of a list of horrible war crimes. But we'll get him one of these days. I know the subreddit's crying out for Mengele, and eventually I am going to show them why they don't want what they think they want. No one's going to have a good time with this episode. It is weird. The people are demanding Mengele. Got a lot of Mengele stans in the audience who can't wait to get their Mengele queue out. Got a Mengele pill. That was a mistake. Let's move it on. So Mengele, one report from a German Paraguayan who was in country at the time says that Mengele in 1959 made a living in Paraguay as a salesman for a manure spreading business. Post-war Nazi careers are always like weird.
Why did they make them do shit? Like, if you're just fucking like put them in a hotel or something, like these comedy fucking jobs.
Yeah, no, they're making money. The guy who claimed this told Alex Shumatov, "I didn't know he was a doctor, and we talked about business and never the war. I figured he didn't want to talk about it."
Probably not. Maybe he probably did. I see. Probably fucked up saying he would love to talk.
Probably
about
didn't
shit.
Want to talk about the war. Yeah, whatever. Yeah. So some reports do allege that Stroessner and Mengele were close friends also and knew each other well. I have not come across any convincing evidence of this, but it's almost certain that Mengele traveled through and spent time in Paraguay. He gets citizenship at one point in time. So it's certainly possible that he and Stroessner had a degree of social interactions together. Now, that's all pretty bad, James. When you are smuggling Dr. Joseph Mengele to safety, that's a bad thing to do. That's high up on the list of least forgivable things. And I'm very pro-smuggling, but not if you're smuggling Nazis. You know? Fentanyl, totally fine. Old electronics that you stole from people's cars, great. Catalytic converters, excellent.
Based. Yeah, copper. I saw some guys getting some copper today. I was really proud of them.
Mm-hmm, exactly. We need the smuggling community to come together against smuggling Joseph Mengele places. Mm-hmm. Look, not even once, folks. Not even once. Anyway, The government's tolerance of Nazis led the fairly small Paraguayan Jewish population to have some awkward experiences after World War II. And this is where things get very weird, James. This is a really odd little story I've got for you. I found a peculiar but unique account of life in Stroessner's Paraguay written by a person who at the time was a young boy named Michael Caine. Now, not that Michael Caine.
Okay.
This Michael Caine is basically a fascist. Yeah, and he grew up in... This is so weird. The guy, I found this in like this guy's blog. He's just like writing about his time as a little boy in Stroessner's Paraguay. Yeah. He grew up in the UK in a peace church called the Bruderhof, which was part of a network of pacifist Anabaptist religious communities that had started spreading out from Germany in 1920. Now, Michael's like three, I think, in 1941, when his family has to flee the UK. When the war breaks out, the UK puts Germans in concentration camps. Yeah. Now, nicer ones than the German concentration camps, it must be said. But that's why his family leaves. They're like, this is not, it seems like maybe being German in the UK in 1941 yeah, isn't ideal. We might want to bounce. Yeah. So,
well, unless you're the monarch, of course, in which case.
Unless you are the monarch. So his family flees the UK for the only country that will accept their peace church during the war years, which is Paraguay. Michael's recollections are on his website, and I have not looked into the Bruderhof a lot. It is, again, it's like a pacifist Anabaptist network of religious communities. Michael claims that he suffered terrible sexual abuse and paints a picture of the Bruderhof in Paraguay as a cult. Entirely possible this is true. It would not be out of line with a lot of similar movements. I have no particular reason to doubt him on this. We will be using Michael's account today because it provides some context on how German Jewish and the German Nazi diaspora communicated, which is an interesting thing, right? That you have these Jewish people who have fled to Paraguay and these Nazis who have fled to Paraguay. And because they're all German, they wind up like involved with each other sometimes. And
that is awkward. I'd be communicating with a brick. Yeah.
That would be, and again, Michael, he is writing as an adult about his experiences as a child in this like expat community. This same bar, he's talking about like a bar that he was brought to as a kid for like a business deal. This same bar used to be owned by Schortzel. His real name was Emil Wolf, a German Jew, and his place was used for years by Nazis and Jews who were all involved in business and all of them good friends. As a 14-year-old, the Bruderhof put me to work in Asunción, where they bought a new house in Vulgicio Moreno. They rented a large house in Independencia Nacional, two doors down from Wolf. I went to Schortzel's bar with Alfred, a brother from the Bruderhof, who wanted a drink of beer but had no money, but I did, so we went together. Soon, Schortzel approached me for some business in wood-turned products that the Bruderhof was selling. That's how I became a good friend of Schortzel. With Jews, the key to a good friendship is money. When
oh, no.
I came round...
Oh, dear.
When
I... Oh, dear.
Oh, boy.
Oh, no. Do we want to keep reading, Robert?
Yeah, one last sentence. When I came round to Schortzel's with wooden articles, he called me Weihnachtsmann, and I called him Saujud. Now, I looked these nicknames up because I was like, what kind of nicknames do basically a Nazi boy and a Jewish boy come up with for each other? Weihnachtsmann basically means Santa Claus. That's the Jewish guy is calling him Santa Claus, right? Because he's buying him a beer. And Saujud, that nickname, which is this kid's nickname for his Jewish friend, comes from the term Judensau, which is a medieval racial caricature that depicts Jewish children suckling at the teats of the pig. It is a racial slur. So like his friend is like, hey, Santa Claus. And he's like, hey, slur, like, hey, racial slur, buddy. Awkward. Look, I would love to find, I haven't found really any other accounts of like the complicated interactions of the Jewish diaspora German community in Paraguay and the Nazi. I assume this happened in places like Argentina too. It's a fascinating topic. I would love to read more on the matter. Hopefully I'll find something else at some point. I just kind of
just
accidentally
phenomenal.
Stumbled into this.
Yeah. The shit that people will put on the internet without being forced to. Like, you could not send me to Guantanamo Bay if I had been giving my friends slur nicknames and get it out of me. But this guy's just apparently popped it out on the internet for the world to see.
I mean, I don't entirely know what's happening with the fascist Michael Caine, but his blog is a real one.
No, there was a time when boomers were blogging. And It's a powerful thing. Insight into the brain. Speaking
of fascist Michael Caine, do you know what the non-fascist Michael Caine loves?
Blowing the doors off things.
Is that a thing that Michael Caine did a lot of?
Is that the Michael Caine, isn't it? In what's it called?
He's in a lot of stuff. He's Michael Caine.
I
mean, he was in the Batman movies. He's Alfred.
I think so.
Does he blow the doors off of something?
Oh, really? I don't know. In the Italian Job, is that not
Michael Caine? Yeah, I think that is Michael Caine. It's been a long time since I've seen the Italian Job.
Fucking hell, I had a moment there. I was worried.
Yeah. No, this is good Michael Caine content. This is an episode rich with Michael's Caine. Anyway, that was a bit of a digression, but I just found it too interesting to not include.
No, fascinating.
This must have happened in a lot of other countries, too. This, like, the German Jewish diaspora and the German Nazi diaspora having some forms of interaction with each other. I would love to read more about that. I just don't know. I haven't run into much else, but yeah, it's a whole thing. And it gives you an idea of the kind of peculiar bedfellows that exist under Stroessner's regime. The main reason that I found Michael's story, though, is that it provides a rare, direct, personal account of the man that Alfredo Stroessner trusted to maintain his secret torture police, who were his primary instrument of maintaining power. And this man was named Pastor Miliciades Coronel. Born in August of 1919, Coronel worked for the Education and Culture Ministry. When Stroessner came to power, he was like part of the Department of Education. And then Stressner's like, no, you seem like more of a torture guy to me. I'm going to put you in charge of my torture department. Coronel was noted to be an obsessive bureaucrat. He loves paperwork. Part of what we know so much about this guy is every arrest and every torture that they do is documented. Every surveilled dissident is recorded and filed away. But he's not just a paperwork guy. He likes to get down there and get his hands dirty. In 1975, when his forces arrested the secretary of the Paraguayan Communist Party, Pastor Coronel had him dismembered by chainsaw while he watched. That is, we don't come into enough chainsaw killings in this show, but there we go. That's
it's always good to break new ground when it comes to like state violence.
Yeah, no, it's nice. He's like a Robert Rodriguez villain, this guy. So Coronel is a dedicated student of torture. He practiced it himself, but he was also a keen admirer of the world's greatest torture experts at the time, which was the U.S. police. Now, we know that the FBI sent him friendly letters as well as books on law enforcement. Like the director of the FBI is like sending this guy like textbooks to be like, here you go, this will help you make your torture police. Don't worry, we know all about it. We also know that through Operation Condor, the FBI kept abreast of whenever Paraguayan dissidents would pop up in surrounding countries that had right-wing dictatorships allied with the U.S., which at this point was all of Paraguay's neighbors. This brings me to the 1958 story of Gladys Sanaman and Agustin Guibero. They were physicians in the capital who refused to falsify an autopsy report to claim a victim of Coronel's police had died of natural causes. Instead, Dr. Sanaman took the corpse to a class in her medical school and performed the autopsy in front of her students so that there would be people who knew what had happened to this man. It was just the only thing she could think of to do to make sure that the truth got out. Like, if I write anything about this, they will purge it. So I am going to autopsy this murder victim in front of my students so they see what our government's doing. Very sensibly, she and her husband fled the country for Brazil. Now, they're in Brazil for a little while before the Brazilian military seizes power. And so then they have to flee Brazil. And the next place they move, Argentina, falls to a U.S.-backed military dictatorship in 1976. This gives you an idea of like how tough it is to be any kind of dissident in South America at this time, right? They're like running as fast as they can, always just ahead of the next U.S.-backed military coup. And I'm going to quote from the New York Times here. Hours after the coup, the Argentine police abducted Dr. Sanaman and tortured her at the Escuela Mecanisa in Buenos Aires. Dr. Sanaman said she was bound and plunged into a bathtub of vomit and excrement. They accused me of killing a patient in my office, Dr. Sanaman said, calling the charge a total lie. Then the police falsely accused her of selling drugs, she said. A week later, Dr. Sanaman's husband was abducted and tortured as well. Dr. Sanaman landed at the Emboscada camp for political prisoners in Paraguay, where she treated more than 400 fellow prisoners from several South American countries, including women whose husbands had been executed and their children. The women, she said, had been imprisoned to silence them. Dr. Sandemann and her husband were eventually given asylum in Germany in 1997 after the German government pressed Argentina to bring about their release. The fate of Dr. Guibru, who also refused to whitewash torture, remained a mystery until the archives were opened. In 1977, he was kidnapped from a street in Misiones, an Argentine town where he had gone to escape the Stroessner regime. And, you know, he's executed by the regime. He's killed once he gets back. We have some personal accounts of Pastor Coronel's torture tactics as well. Senator Carlos Levy Ruffinelli was the leader of the Liberal Party, a controlled opposition party Stroessner allowed to exist to provide the illusion of democracy. And even though this was, he's letting this guy basically live to be controlled opposition, he still arrests him 19 times and has him tortured 6 times.
That guy, a bold dude, just keep coming back for more.
He is a brave man. And I'm going to quote from him now, talking about his experiences under Coronel's torturers. "Most of the time, I did not know what they wanted. They did not even know what they wanted. But when they put the needles under your fingernails, you tell them anything, you denounce everybody, and then they say, 'See, you were lying to us all the time.'" Now, I found an even more detailed and horrific account of Pastor Coronel's jails in a BBC article by Simon Watts. Almada came to the attention of the secret police in the early 1970s when he and his wife, Celestina, were working as teachers in a school where they had set up on the outskirts of Asunción. Their politics were left-wing, and they campaigned for better salaries and working conditions for teachers and for changes to the curriculum. One evening, the secret police came for him. After 30 days of interrogation, Almada was officially classified as an intellectual terrorist and an ignoramus. He was sent to the infamous Emboscada open-air prison, where he was held for 3 years. Celestina died shortly after Almada's arrest in what the police said was a suicide. Almada has always believed she died because police played her recordings of him being tortured. "The telephone was used as an instrument of psychological torture," he says. "For 8 days, they made her listen systematically to everything that happened to me. Then they sent her my bloodied clothing. Finally, they called her one night and said, 'The subversive teacher is dead. Come and get his body.' She died of a heart attack," he says. "She died of grief." And again, all of this is based on teachings that the FBI handed down to Coronel and his police. They sent trainers. The CIA sent trainers. Like, U.S. cops taught Coronel's cops how to do all this. None of this was, you know, separate from American politics in Latin America at the time.
Yeah, there are people alive today whose taxes help to pay for that, so that's great.
Anyway, to the FBI agents listening, I hope you enjoyed this proud recitation of your history here.
What a glorious institution.
The evidence keeps pouring in. At this point, the facts are undeniable. It's an open and shut case. Monopoly Go is the most fun you can have in a mobile game. Millions of people pass Go every day because this game is always bringing something new to the table. Countless crazy tournaments you can join with your friends as partners or teams. Constantly changing challenges like money sprees or treasure hunts that keep it fresh with new wild mini-games. Timed events offering bonuses like massive multipliers or rent frenzies to help you get huge rewards. And there's so many rewards to discover. Rare stickers you can trade with friends to complete albums, delightful emojis to taunt people with when you raid their riches, unique playing pieces, and so much more. The verdict is in with Monopoly Go. There's something new to discover every time you play. So don't miss out. Go download it now for free on the App Store and Google Play. My favorite spring cleaning takeaway is the post-clean clarity you get. Wow, how have I been living like this? It's kind of like when you find out you've been paying a fortune for wireless, when Mint Mobile has phone plans for $15 a month when you purchase a 3-month plan. Wow, how have I been affording this? It's time to switch to Mint Mobile and get unlimited talk, text, and data for $15 a month. Say bye-bye to your overpriced wireless plans, jaw-dropping monthly bills, and unexpected overages. Mint Mobile is here to rescue you with premium wireless plans starting at $15 a month. All plans come with high-speed data and unlimited talk and text delivered on the nation's largest 5G network. Use your own phone with any Mint Mobile plan and bring your phone number along with all your existing contacts. To get this new customer offer and your new 3-month unlimited wireless plan for just $15 a month, go to mintmobile.com/behind. That's mintmobile.com/behind. Cut your wireless bill to $15 a month at mintmobile.com/behind. $45 upfront payment required, equivalent to $15 a month. New customers on first 3-month plan only. Speed slower above 40 gigabytes on unlimited plan. Additional taxes, fees, and restrictions apply. See Mint Mobile for details.
Focus Features presents Back to Black.
I want people to hear my voice and just forget their troubles.
Experience the music and her story.
Know this.
I ain't no Spice Girl.
Like never before.
That's my daughter. That's my Amy.
On the big screen.
I want to be remembered for just being me.
Amy Winehouse, Back to Black. Directed by Sam Taylor Johnson. Rated R. Under 17, not a minute without parent. Only in theaters May 17th.
So thanks to those now open archives, we also know that Stressner, after he took power, a U.S. military colonel named Robert Terry, T-H-E-I-R-R-Y, he lived in Texas, actually came to Paraguay to put together a lot of the basic structure of Stressner's police state as part of a broader U.S. plan to crack down on left-wing organizing in the entire region. The FBI handled a lot of the grunt work. On one occasion, a dissident from Pinochet's regime in Chile fled to Paraguay. He was arrested and interrogated by Coronel's men. They then called up the FBI, who interrogated Chilean relatives of the dissident who were living in the United States, and then handed that information to Pinochet, who disappeared the dissident once he'd been handed over. This is the way things worked in Latin America, much of it. Clarence Kelly, who was head of the FBI at the time, sent Coronel a Christmas letter wishing him, quote, a truly joyous Christmas and a new year filled with all the good things you so richly deserve. Good guys.
Jesus Christ.
Good yeah. guys. Yes. Now, earlier I read you a quote from that weird Michael Caine guy's blog. I decided to highlight some of this kind of a Nazi's recollections because as a child, he lived near Pastor Coronel and he spent time with the man. And there's not a lot of context on this guy. So he's some of like the only evidence I've found about what Stressner's chief torturer was like as a person. And this is kind of interesting. On this day, I first met Pastor Coronel. He was about 5 years older than me. His uncle Don and rather Mayor Coronel owned a neighboring estancia ranch to the Bruderhof. His estancia was called San Martin. In Paraguay, landowners like to give themselves military titles for importance, hence the mayor title. Mayor Coronel habitually carried a gun. He must have read the little red book by Chairman Mao, whereon it says, page 48, the power of the people comes out of the barrel of a gun. For this reason, he was highly respected or feared, depending on your language. It was him who let me shoot his Colt 45 revolver for the first time in my life. The recoil hurt my thumb. This made all the Paraguayan onlookers laugh really loud.
Oh, man, this kind of prose is really a gift to the yeah. internet. It's given yes. us.
It's amazing. It's amazing.
You'd legitimately never know what this fucker's going to come up with next.
I know. It's this man is fascinating.
Yeah. Wow. Just a stream of consciousness.
Yeah. It's
unedited.
It's one of those little gifts that you you come across when you're doing a deep enough dive. That's just like, yeah, no one would put this in a scholarly. Because, like, I can't verify any of this, but I'm not going to put it in a podcast. It's just too incredible.
Yeah, it's a hidden gem of the... Like, this guy now is commenting on Facebook shit about how he... I don't know. Powerfully divorced vibe.
Yeah, I'm not surprised that Michael Caine grew up to be the most divorced man on the internet.
Yes, yeah. Hates his children.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Oh, perfect. Yeah. Yes. Nom, 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 nom. Give it all to me, James. That's what I love the internet for.
Yeah. This is the true goal.
So, back to Paraguay. It has always been pretty deeply fucked from an economic justice point of view. Today it actually has, fun fact, James, the most unequal land distribution of any nation on Earth. 90% of its land is owned by 12,000 people. Now,
Jesus Christ.
That's not great. This state of affairs actually started because of the War of the Triple Alliance, which left most Paraguayans dead and their land up for grabs, right? There's a lot of land that there's no one alive left to own.
No one left.
Yeah. And in the wake of that calamity, the next dictators basically sold everything that wasn't nailed down, all these dead people's land, to fund rebuilding and to fund themselves. And during this period, 32 firms purchased almost half of the country. One Spanish businessman purchased 7 million hectares, which is more than a full Ireland of private property. Yeah, that's too much land for a person to have.
Yeah. No one needs that much. What was he doing with it all?
There's a brisk debate to be had about the extent to private property. No one should be able to own in Ireland.
that's too much.
The consequences of this led directly to a situation where all wealth in Paraguay was determined by land ownership, because land gave one the ability to exploit minerals or other natural resources, or at least charge rent. When Stroessner came to power, the first person he killed was a government official tasked with carrying out a land reform policy to remedy this inequality. That is the first guy he has murdered, is this guy doing the land reform.
Great.
And yeah, I'm going to quote next from an article in EarthSight. As part of these clientelist networks, Stroessner divided what remained of public land among his allies. 8 million hectares were given away or sold at negligible prices to army generals and Colorado grandees. This land was ostensibly destined for small-scale farmers as part of a program of agrarian reform, and so has come to be known as Las Tierras Malhabidas, the ill-gotten lands.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's cool. It's a good story.
Yeah, it's great.
Yeah.
Yeah. No problems there at all. He started off on a great note, didn't he?
Yeah, yeah. So this leads to a pretty long-running series of massacres of what are called campesinos, who are tenant farmers attempting to protest for land reform. For Stroessner, this also forms a crucial part of the network of bribery and other way-looking that powers his dictatorship. To get military officers on his side, he hands out high-level positions in state monopolies or land, and then he also has Pastor Coronel's secret police stand aside and ignore the illegal trade and contraband so that they can make a shitload of money smuggling stuff into the country. Peter Lambert writes of this. Contraband, often quoted as the price of peace and involving the vast majority of officials through their control of the frontier zones, guaranteed the complicity of the military establishment and the maintenance of a lucrative status quo. In the words of Eduardo Galeano, the generals fill their pockets and hatch no plots. So basically, he kills the guy who is responsible for redistributing land to the peasants. He takes all this land, he gives it to his generals, particularly land on the borders, which they then use in order to carry out, like, basically create smuggling networks, right? To bring products in that are not taxed. And this is fucked up. It's a mixed bag for much of the population, because one thing this does is that you can actually get a lot of shit cheaper in Paraguay than you can in like the US where it's being made. Like TVs are cheaper there and shit for a while because it's like no taxes. And everyone in the government understands part of why we're not dealing with any uprisings right now is that like people can get cheap TVs and the money from those cheap TVs bribes the generals not to upset the apple cart. You know, it's a pretty intelligent system. It's evil, but it's smart, right?
Right. How are you funding your state, though, if people aren't paying taxes? And
well, a lot of people aren't paying taxes. You do have, like, a shit... I mean, honestly, the answer
CIA
to that, James,
money,
is the CIA, right? Like, he's getting eventually tens of millions of dollars from the United States.
Utopian socialism.
But it's a perfect system. What if the CIA could fund civic programs here to rebuild roads and bridges?
Don't even think about it, Robin. Nope.
Dropping in CIA agents to like clean up that part of town in Ohio that the train just nuked.
Just torturing the dude who runs Norfolk Southern.
Yeah, backing a dictator in Ohio, but then also cleaning up the land. It's a mixed bag in Ohio. Yeah. Half the population's been tortured to death, but the sea's cleaner now. The sea. It's Ohio. What am I saying?
Yeah, the Ohio Ocean.
Yeah, the Ohio Ocean, we call it.
It's where the land sharks come from.
We've talked a good amount about the torture and murder Stroessner's chief attack dog, pastor. And by the way, pastor's not like a religious term. It's like, pastor is what I should be saying. But you know me in pronunciations. It's his first name is Pastor. Pastor Coronel carried out. But what's perhaps more interesting is how relatively rarely he needed to do this. The early years of the Stroessner regime established such a baseline of terror that Paraguayan civil society was comprehensively beaten down. And it had been pretty beaten down earlier, right? So kind of what happens after he takes power is most people are like, yeah, man, he sucks, but we're not dealing with the civil war every year. And like, you know, the corruption at least means cheap TVs. So why don't we just give up on politics, right? Yeah. Like that's how Lambert kind of describes what happens to the people. And he calls this the institutionalization of repression and defines that as a demobilization of civil society due to a perception that politics is only the domain of soldiers and the leaders who control them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You don't have, like, if civil society is like non-state actors who make demands of the state, like, what the fuck is the point in making demands of the state when either it changes every 5 minutes or it kills you?
Exactly. And I'm going to read another quote from Lambert here that makes this point. To a large extent, the regime succeeded in not only demobilizing but depoliticizing civil society, destroying not only the organizational ability of the opposition, but more importantly, the capacity to question, to analyze, and to criticize. The repression and co-option of nascent opposition led to an apparent acceptance of the status quo, a cynicism toward politics, a disinterest in what was seen as an area reserved for elites and prohibited to the masses. And to be fair, the stability that Stroessner brings with him makes it easy for the people who aren't being targeted by the government to feel this way. Regular people are benefiting from this situation in a lot of ways, and the 1970s see an economic explosion as Paraguay finally recovers from both the Chaco War and its decades of instability. For a while, it has the highest growth rate of any South American country, and a lot of this is due to the fact that there's a joint Brazilian-Paraguayan project to create a massive hydroelectric dam in Itaipu. Today, I believe the Itaipu Dam is still the most productive hydroelectric power project on the planet. Like, it's a pretty good idea to have this dam there. You know, not that that's up to Stroessner, but he greenlights it. And massive corruption ensures that Paraguayan industry, like, this is part of the problem, is that, like, this is a great thing to have in your country, like this incredibly productive power dam. They have a contract basically with Brazil where they split the power 50-50 and Brazil, like, funds the construction. But because of massive corruption, none of the 50% of Itaipu's power that's supposed to go to Paraguay actually goes towards, you know, building an industrial base or doing anything to improve the economy. So the project temporarily brings an economic boom because so many Paraguayans are working on it, but they're not going to actually use the resources that it generates to improve the economy in any meaningful way, which is going to be a problem for everybody in a little bit here. Paraguay's boom years are also helped by regular infusions of cash from the United States and the IMF to the eventual tune of hundreds of millions of dollars. In exchange, Stroessner keeps Paraguay as a compliant and stress-free part of Operation Condor. The CIA never needs to send in black ops teams to the country or fund paramilitary death squads. There's no grinding left-wing insurgency that threatens the stability of the government. The fact that Stroessner was generally good for U.S. policy aims, and the undeniable fact that life under his rule was at least more stable than life under previous dictators, led some in the international community to call him a good dictator. George Landau, a U.S. ambassador to the country, called Alfredo benign, as dictatorships go.
Oh, God, there it is.
Yeah, I'm sure the teachers being soaked in shit and then murdered are, this is benign, basically, as dictatorships go.
You know, television's cheap. What are you going to do? It's nice.
One of the things fucking George Landau says is that, well, you know, political prisoners in Paraguay generally get out of prison alive as long as they have powerful friends.
No, yeah, great. Well, that's not a problem.
No, that's good. We're good.
Thank
you. I was worried we were complicit in nightmarish evil again. But you know what? It's good. We're fine.
Shining city on a hill shit, as always, the United States.
I am at the ghost of George Washington speaking on a mountain above D.C. We will build a nation where political prisoners sometimes get out of prison if their friends are powerful.
That's one of the things that they didn't put on my becoming an American test.
No, that's one of those like little quotes they write in your passport book.
Yeah, I'm sure.
You know what else winds up written in your passport book?
Is it corporations?
Yeah, I mean, kind of.
How many piles of gold you've bought?
If you have enough gold, you don't even need a passport, Sophie.
You know what? Innovative. I like it.
Thank you. The evidence keeps pouring in. At this point, the facts are undeniable. It's an open and shut case. Monopoly Go is the most fun you can have in a mobile game. Millions of people pass Go every day because this game is always bringing something new to the table. Countless crazy tournaments you can join with your friends as partners or teams. Constantly changing challenges like money sprees or treasure hunts that keep it fresh with new wild mini-games. Timed events offering bonuses like massive multipliers or rent frenzies to help you get huge rewards. And there's so many rewards to discover. Rare stickers you can trade with friends to complete albums, delightful emojis to taunt people with when you raid their riches, unique playing pieces, and so much more.
The verdict is in with Monopoly Go. There's something new to discover every time you play. So don't miss out. Go download it now for free on the App Store and Google Play. Me.
Focus Features presents Back to Black.
I want people to hear my voice and just forget their troubles.
Experience the music and her story.
Know this.
I ain't no Spice Girl.
Like never before.
That's my daughter. That's my Amy.
On the big screen.
I want to be remembered for just being me.
Amy Winehouse, Back to Black. Directed by Sam Taylor Johnson. Rated R. Under 17, not a minute without parent. Only in theaters May 17th.
What kind of fun is waiting for you at King's Island? The holy cow, we're way too high and here comes the drop kind of fun. The make a splash all summer kind of fun. The I can't believe I ate that whole funnel cake. Let's get another kind of fun. But most importantly, at King's Island, you'll find for the fun of it kind of fun.
Don't wait to start your fun season. King's Island is now open on weekends.
Ah, we're back. Mm-hmm. We're all having a good time. Everybody's happy. The story's mm-hmm. happy. Yeah. So, George Landau, our good friend, the U.S. ambassador to Paraguay for a while, claims that Stroessner repeatedly complained in the late 70s that he was tired of ruling and that he wanted to retire to a life of fishing and hunting, but that Paraguay needed him. Landau claimed he believed, as most dictators do, that he was absolutely irreplaceable. He talked himself into a sense of duty. Now, that's horseshit. I'm sorry.
Where's Landau? Actually, where's he writing this? Like, is he just like doing op-eds?
Yeah, in like Asuncion. Yeah, he's like. I think this is like, yeah, while he's probably. Like
oh
after,
yeah,
I think
I
he leaves in 79
and shit.
Yeah. So, I believe that, and other sources I found will argue, that Stroessner basically gets addicted to total power.
Yeah.
And kind of loses the ability to conceive of anyone else making decisions about his country. It is interesting to read accounts like Landau's by Americans who talked to Stroessner during this period, because, like, everyone in Paraguay, like, all of the people in his cabinet, every other leader, has to treat him as kind of a cross between, like, God and the devil, because his whim can destroy their lives, right?
Right.
So no one can talk to him honestly. But American soldiers and diplomats, like, are safe, right? Like, you can actually have a conversation with Stroessner because, like, he's not going to fuck up the money, right? He's not an idiot. So taking this into account, I found a letter to the editor of National Review by a former U.S. soldier who traveled to Paraguay for work during Stroessner's time in office that I found really interesting. In very good English, he said, "I am President Alfredo Stroessner, and I would like to thank you for showing us your aircraft. Since I am in my country, custom requires that I continue this conversation in Spanish with my interpreter," which he did. His interpreter was far less fluent in English than the leader. We gave him a tour of the airplane and answered all his questions about it. Then he philosophized for a few minutes. We never understood why. The remark that has struck with me to this day was, "I am sure you have heard that I am a dictator. That is true, but I am a benevolent dictator, which my country needs. We are a backward country, and my people are not ready for democracy." We wisely made no comment on the remark, and shortly after, we launched for our return flight to the Canal Zone.
Jesus Christ.
Yeah, and it's interesting, because this guy he's literally writing the editor of National Review. I'm going to assume this serviceman is pretty conservative. But he ends his letter by noting, "We knew very well even then there was nothing benevolent about Stroessner's dictatorship," which is more honest than George Landau was willing to be.
Sure. Yeah, this guy's not cut out for a career in foreign service.
No.
Imagine you're there showing him your aeroplane, just being like, "Oh, I'm glad that we're sharing our military assets with this piece of shit boomer.
I feel good about my service today."
I signed up to defend this country.
God willing. As the 1980s dawned, Alfredo's power was at its apparent height. From the New York Times. President Stroessner was never one for understatement. His name, written in neon, flashed nightly over the Asuncion cityscape during his reign. And his face was plastered.
He's a man of the times. He's adopted neon.
Yeah, he's ready for the Reagan years.
Yeah.
His face was plastered daily in the newspapers and on television. He was known for turning up in his powder blue military uniform every Thursday at the General Staff Headquarters of the Armed Forces. John Vinokur, writing in the New York Times magazine in 1984, offered this snapshot of Paraguay as its army goose-stepped down the boulevards to celebrate General Stroessner's 30 years in power. A continual state of siege over the entire period that literally places the president above the law. People with occasionally uncontrollable urges to fall into rivers or jump from planes with their arms and legs bound. Serenades in front of the presidential palace featuring the ever-popular Forward, My General, and Congratulations, My Great Friend. Foreign thieves, brutes, and madmen hidden at a price. An economy administered so corruptly it is officially explained away as the cost of peace. A United Nations voting record on so-called key issues more favorable to the United States than any other ally, a party newspaper that prints 6 4-page color pictures of the general every day.
Jesus Christ.
What a great country. Things are going well.
What a powerful image. Anytime you've got goose-stepping military and anyone in power for 30 years, I should set off some alarm bells.
Yeah. Now, appearances can be deceiving, James, because when the construction of the Itaipu Dam stopped in 1981, that just so happened to occur at the same time as a global collapse in the value of cotton and soybean, which were Paraguay's two biggest crops. So because due to rampant corruption, none of this power generated by Itaipu is being used to like help them create a better industrial base, Paraguay's economy takes a long walk off a short pier at this point in time. The balance of payments and deficit for Paraguay gets so bad that Stroessner is finally forced to abandon his fixed rate for the currency. Inflation rises sharply, and with it comes the first stirrings of resistance to his regime. Now, in addition to the fact that the economy has taken a shit, Stroessner's an old man at this point. His health troubles him, and he's forced to hand over more and more control to his underlings, like Pastor Coronel, who begins actively scheming to replace him. To cope with the stress, Alfredo increasingly gravitates to the only hobby that makes it all better. James, what do you do when you're stressed out? How do you chill out?
I go for bike rides. I go rock climbing.
Okay, interesting.
I camp. Are those his favorite activities, too? I make spoons. Wooden spoons.
That's interesting. Those are all great hobbies, James. Alfredo takes a slightly different route. He gets really involved in child sex trafficking. I'm going to read a quote.
Different kind of spooning to the kind of spooning I enjoy.
Oh boy. I'm going to quote from Alex Shumatov from Vanity Fair. Stroessner was no doubt aware of the inevitable waning of his powers, and his solution to the problem seems to have been schoolgirls, muchachitas.
Oh, no.
They were his elixir. Maybe he thought that the intercambio de hormonas would keep him young. He wasn't alone in his predilection for this therapy. His friend Perone, who liked boys as well, consoled himself with a 14-year-old after the death of Evita. In the opinion of Stroessner's family surgeon, Manuel Riveros, there was nothing abnormal about an old man having a soft spot for nymphets. This is an article from the 80s in Vanity Fair. So the writer's a bastard too. Look, let's not be wrong here. Youth is contagious, he told me. Trujillo crossed the streets of Santo Domingo looking for girls. Bocasa cruised the streets of Bangui. Stroessner cruised the streets of Asuncion. It went with the turf. The girls were Don Alfredo's draw de seigneur.
Oh dear.
Oh dear.
Now, it's not very good.
Alex Shumatov is a prestige magazine journalist writing in the 1980s, so he's a kind of gross guy in some ways.
This guy's an extreme fucking creep.
I don't even start it, James.
Oh god,
here's Alex again.
Give me more of his pay on to pedophilia.
It is hard not to notice the schoolgirls, slender, tan, mestiza beauties budding in their white uniforms, who pour into the streets of Asuncion at noon. After a long morning, Stroessner would park near one of the schools and watch them come out. When he had made his pick, his aides would find out who the girl was and approach the parents with an offer of cash or real estate. If all else failed, the girl was kidnapped and given an injection that made her more cooperative. If she got pregnant, she was sent to the best hospital and treated by the best doctors. How many children the Tyrannosaurus or produced is unknown, but there are thought to be many.
I am feeling physically unwell.
So that's fucked up. Yeah. And this is obviously, if you are this guy reporting for a huge magazine on this, this is critical stuff to report on. You don't need to describe how attractive the schoolgirls are, Alex. That's bad. That makes me think you're a monster too.
That story.
Wildly inappropriate. Terrible.
Wow. So yeah. Jesus Christ.
Good stuff. Mm-hmm. One of the people procuring children for the dictator was Colonel Leopoldo Perrier, who scoured the countryside for 8 to 12-year-old peasant girls and brought...
Fuck me!
Very young. And he would bring them to safe houses in suburban-like neighborhoods that had playgrounds so that they would be amused while they waited for the general. That's like the worst detail.
Yeah,
for
man.
Reason.
Fucking hell. If you've got a slide for your girlfriends, like, you're doing it wrong.
I'm going to read another very rough two sentences from that Vanity Fair article.
I'm bracing.
One of Stressner's conquests was the 15-year-old daughter of the head of the national cement industry. As part of the seductions, she and her brother got a trip to Disney World.
Oh, man. Good hell.
Now,
that is dark.
That is rough. Yeah. This story was first broken by Jack Anderson in the Washington Post in 1977, who from what I recall of his article, does not write anything creepy about these children. He like bases his article off of an interview he conducts with a woman named Melina Ashwell. And Melina is the daughter of a Paraguayan official stationed in Washington, D.C., who tells him that 2 years earlier in 75, back in the Capitol, they'd been having lunch with a colleague when they were called over to the mansion next door, where they saw the unconscious bodies of 2 8-year-old girls and 1 9-year-old girl who were both bleeding between their legs. Ashwell called the police, but they had like the police show up, but they leave immediately because somebody points out that the house is owned by Colonel Perrier. The house is apparently a brothel frequented by the dictator himself. And she calls, once the police leave, she calls a local journalist and tries to give him the story before she goes to the Post. But the journalist she tells this all to, the Paraguayan journalist, gets arrested for communism, and a raid of his house turns up the text of her interview. So she gets tortured for 3 days. She's only saved because her dad is influential. When Anderson publishes this story, wheels start turning in the Carter White House. And thankfully, Carter is not unwilling to back dictators, as he does in El Salvador during this period of time. But this is far too much for Jimmy Carter. And the United States cuts aid to Stressner's dictatorship. Now, Reagan winds up in the office very shortly thereafter. And Reagan's like, oh, we have no problem supporting a pedophile with military. This is totally fine. Yeah.
Ronald Reagan switches that policy right back.
They do lose out on money during this period where the economy is also in the shitter, and that creates problems. It weakens Stressner's regime, right? It's one of the things that contributes to the weakening of his regime. By 1982, campesinos who lost their job, or in 1982, campesinos who'd lost their jobs when the dam was finished started to protest again for land reform. This got in the way of the dreams of Stressner's cabinet members and military officers. Villages were declared centers of delinquency and subversion and forcibly evacuated. The peasantry began to desert Stressner as a result. By the late 1980s, the general was sick enough that he could no longer fully control his regime. He'd hoped one of his sons would take over for him, but one of them was an alcoholic and the other was gay, and neither of them had the wherewithal to politic their way through Stressner's cabinet. On February 3rd, General Andres Rodriguez, a close relative of the dictator by marriage, executed a violent coup against Stressner. There's an 8-hour gunfight. Stressner barely gets away in like a limousine from the gunfight, but like there's enough resistance that like he is able to escape and keep his own life, but his troops are not able to stop the soldiers loyal to Rodriguez from taking the capital. By the way, Rodriguez is married to his daughter. He's like his son-in-law, too.
Right.
So
cool.
Stressner is able to negotiate a safe surrender of power, and he and his household are granted, you know, the ability to leave the country. So he survives losing power, which is, again, rules for 35 years, gets out alive. Very rare story in the annals of dictatorships. He had initially hoped to land in Florida because he owned several houses in Florida.
the traditional resting place of retired dictators.
He feared, though, being tried for his crimes. And so when the right-wing military government of Brazil offered him sanctuary, he took it. He spent the last 17 years of his life there, living in comfort until the age of 93.
Jesus.
Yeah.
Wow.
Terrible... Terrible monster
that he didn't
never
die
pays
violently.
For his crimes. Yeah.
Yeah. I was really rooting for Rodriguez there to
put it would have been good if he'd gotten the old Mussolini.
We'd have loved to see that. Yeah.
Or if they did him like Gaddafi. But
yeah, no, put him up as a fucking pinata for 8-year-old girls to
alas, he lives out his life on the beaches of Brazil. So you know. That's a good story.
Yeah, that in many ways not. But it is a story.
That's undeniable. Mm-hmm. You know what else is undeniable, James?
How brutal the ending of this fucking podcast was.
Yeah, well, that was
properly really fucking terrible, Robert.
I really did backload the worst.
God.
Yeah.
That fucking Disneyland shit is, oh my God.
It's pretty rough.
You've said some really horrible things on this podcast.
I read some really horrible things.
That was next level dark. I'm glad you gave like a slight warning to people, because that's just
that was some particularly dark shit.
That is some particularly dark shit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
James?
Robert? Do you have anything to plug?
Yeah. Now that we've talked about child sexual abuse, we've got another podcast in which we much more rarely talk about child sex abuse, which is, you know, so if that's something you don't want to hear about, you can listen to It Could Happen Here. It's sometimes with me, sometimes with Robert and Sophie.
We're going to put that in our vulture write-up.
we'll go soaring up the rankings.
Yeah.
Soaring.
Rarely discusses child sex abuse.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, good stuff. Yeah, it's a thing we won't talk about.
I would like to plug the concept of hugging a nice, friendly animal, like a dog or a cat.
Yeah.
And definitely not Phil.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, he's probably decayed at this point.
He's been dropped, thanks to
Bill
de Blasio.
If you're going to hug an animal, like, you know, really make sure you're in a stable stance.
Make sure the animal wants to hug you back.
Yeah, don't kidnap animals.
And don't let your animal anywhere near Bill de Blasio.
Bill de Blasio adopted it posthumously, and it's now Phil de Blasio.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. I mean, he simply had to at that point. But Robert,
pay for its funeral.
You have a book that people can buy.
I do. It's called After the Revolution. You can find it at AK Press's website or like Amazon or like bookstores. You can go to a bookstore and you could be like, I would like After the Revolution by Robert Evans. And if they say no, whatever weapon you're carrying, you know, you can just whip that out and you know, create a hostage situation until you get a copy of my book.
Or you could request it at your local library.
All of these are equally valid options.
Mm-hmm. My brain is on that photo of Bill de Blasio dropping Phil the ground.
It's very funny. Very funny.
Oh, man. All right. This is over. I've recorded way too long. Yeah. Goodbye.
We're going to go pour one out for Phil.
We'll pour one out for Phil. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Behind the Bastards is a production of Cool Zone Media. For more from Cool Zone Media, visit our website, coolzonemedia.com, or check us out on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. It's a simple truth. No matter who you are, mental health challenges can affect you, and how you manage them can make all the difference. That's why everyone should have access to mental health support that meets them where they are and helps them get through. BetterHelp provides online therapy on your schedule. It's flexible, simple to use, and more affordable than in-person therapy. Connect with a licensed therapist selected just for you. Learn more at BetterHelp.com. That's BetterHelp.com.
What kind of fun is waiting for you at Kings Island? The holy cow, we're way too high and here comes the drop kind of fun. The make a splash all summer kind of fun. I can't believe I ate that whole funnel cake. Let's get another kind of fun. But most importantly, at Kings Island, you'll find for the fun of it kind of fun.
Don't wait to start your fun season. Kings Island is now open on weekends.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.